Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to welcome Adam Hochschild, the author of a new book on Spain, the Spanish Civil War, called Spain in Our Hearts. Adam is known as the author of the War to End All Wars, and also King Leopold's Ghost. And here's Adam. Thanks.
Thank you, George. I'm delighted to find a gavel here. If anybody gets out of order, watch out. It's a pleasure to be here and have a chance to talk to you a little bit about the piece of history I covered in my new book, Spain in Our Hearts. I'm going to be talking about the Spanish Civil War, but first, to sort of set the scene for that, I want to roll the clock back to the 1930s. It was a grim time. At home, we had the Great Depression. Abroad, the Great Depression was taking a similar toll of people not having enough to eat, unemployment, and much more. But it was even worse in Europe because these hardships were fueling some very nasty movements. In Germany, Adolf Hitler was rising to power. In Italy, Benito Mussolini was already in power, and something we often forget about the early 1930s is that there were regimes of the extreme right, usually anti-Semitic, semi-fascist, in power in one way or another in most of Eastern Europe. Fascism was definitely on the rise throughout the continent. As the French writer André Malraux said, fascism has spread its great black wings over Europe. One of the few bright spots was Spain. In 1931, centuries of monarchy and then a recent period of military dictatorship in the 1920s came to an end. Statues toppled. Real nationwide elections were held for the first time. The king left the country, and Spain became a republic. This was something greeted with widespread rejoicing, not just in Spain, this picture is from Madrid, but everywhere. Democracy seemed to have arrived at last in a country that previously had had very little of it. One of the big losers in this change in Spain was the Catholic Church, which had previously controlled all education in the country, which was strictly segregated between the sexes. Education for women was very strong on sewing and religion and not much else. There were still vast problems in Spain. It was a country with huge disparities of wealth, a small elite at the very top, large landowners who owned vast estates, and a miserably poor peasantry at the bottom, people living in dirt-floored huts, millions and millions of peasants with little or no land. More than a quarter of the population of Spain was illiterate, one of the highest rates in Europe. In early 1936, progressives and Democrats around the world felt a further surge of optimism about Spain because in elections held early that year, a coalition of left and liberal parties won the national elections. And now it seemed the Spanish people had spoken and wanted more social and economic justice, and there was much that could be done. Then in July of 1936, shockwaves were felt around the world when a large group of right-wing army officers rose up against the elected government of the Spanish Republic. The Spanish Civil War had begun. And this was by far the largest armed conflict on the European continent since World War I. These right-wing officers called themselves nationalists. They were determined to overthrow the elected government of the Republic. They quickly came under the leadership of a tough-talking young general named Francisco Franco. What did they want? They wanted an end to democracy, a Spain based on those large estates in the countryside. What little land reform had been done under the Republic was to be rolled back. They wanted the supremacy of the army. It was clear that they were imposing a military dictatorship. There would be no trappings of democracy, no elections, no free press, no political parties allowed. They also wanted to restore the Catholic Church to a central role. And they handed, in the part of Spain that the nationalists rapidly took over, they handed control of education back to the church. And the Catholic Church, Catholic hierarchy in Spain, which was by far the most reactionary in Europe, backed Franco wholeheartedly. Someone else who backed Franco in his attempt to seize power wholeheartedly was Adolf Hitler. And widespread horror spread throughout Europe that Hitler now had a new ally. He immediately sent help to Franco and the nationalists, arms, military advisors, ammunition, tanks and tank drivers, aircraft, military aircraft, and pilots. For Hitler, joining the Spanish Civil War on the side of the nationalists was not only a chance to try to help bring a sympathetic dictator to power, but to try out weapons for the much larger war that he was planning and indeed would soon launch a couple of years later. For example, the Messerschmitt 109 fighter plane, the mainstay of the German Luftwaffe during World War II, was used in combat for the first time in Spain. Same thing with the Stuka dive bomber, which later would be widely used in World War II. Benito Mussolini also pitched in to help the Spanish nationalists, supplied not just arms, artillery, military advisors, but 80,000 ground troops as well. With this help from Germany and Italy, the nationalists who had originally seized about a third of Spain within a week or two of staging the uprising, the area colored gray on this map, after 3 or 4 months, quickly gained ground and held roughly half of the country. And as you can see from the map, they were almost at the outskirts of Madrid. The area that's colored red was that held, still held by the Spanish Republic. The war raged on. Hitler and Mussolini continued to supply arms, aircraft, advisors to the nationalists. The Italians, for example, sent more than 600 military aircraft over the course of the war. The Spanish Republic's army was extremely ill-equipped. You can see from this photo, the soldiers have no helmets. That artillery piece in the background is so ancient it doesn't even have rubber-tired wheels. The elected government of the Republic pleaded desperately with the world's major democracies, the United States, Britain, and France, for the right to buy arms from them. And the Spanish Republic had the money to do so because during the First World War, Spain, very fortunately, had remained neutral and had actually made a lot of money doing business with the rest of the world and with both sides in that war while the rest of Europe was spending itself deep into debt. So Spain, Republican Spain, actually had the world's fourth largest gold supply. But all of the democracies refused their request to buy arms. They did not want to get drawn into a violent war in Europe. In the United States, for instance, President Roosevelt, who was certainly sympathetic to the Republic and a man who hated fascism, was also a shrewd politician. He knew that the American people were deeply isolationist and had no appetite for getting involved in a European war of any kind. He was a close reader of opinion polls. He knew that a Gallup poll showed that even though many more Americans favored the Spanish Republic than favored the Spanish nationalists, the great majority of Americans had no opinion about the war whatever. In contrast to another pressing question of the day, which was whether or not King Edward VIII of England should resign his throne in order to marry the woman he loved. On that point, a great majority of Americans knew what they thought. So Roosevelt said no to the Spanish Republic's request to buy arms as well. Another reason people believe that was involved there is that it is widely believed that prior to his first run for re-election in 1936, he had promised the hierarchy of the American Catholic Church that he would not get involved in any way in Spain. For obvious reasons, this was a promise that was never written down on either side, but all historians believe it was made. So finally, the only major country after several months that was willing to sell arms to the Republic was not another democracy. It was Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union. And he demanded a lot in return, specifically high positions for both Spanish and Soviet communists in the Republican Army's high command and in the security forces. But he not only sold the Republic crucial arms, especially aircraft and tanks, but supplied the crews to man them. And he did something else, which was to pass the word to the world's communist parties to begin recruiting volunteers to fight in Spain. And this was the force that became the well-known International Brigades. And their effort, plus the Soviet arms, was enough to prolong the war greatly and to prevent Franco from capturing Madrid. Eventually, these international brigades totaled more than 35,000 men from coming from over 50 countries, a crucial force that fought in all the major battles of the war. This photograph was taken during the Battle for Madrid in late 1936. At that time, the front line between the Nationalists and the Spanish Republic ran right through the university campus on the city's northwestern side. Buildings changed hands over the course of the fighting. These men are, and we don't know what country the ones in the picture are from, but the early volunteers who got there in the fall of 1936 were mainly from Britain, France, and Poland. These men are defending the university's Philosophy and Letters building. And if you look carefully under the row of sandbags at the far left, you can see piles of books that are part of their fortifications there. British volunteers actually calculated that if a book was placed faced out to oncoming fire, a bullet would penetrate about 350 pages before coming to a stop. These international brigades volunteers included some 2,800 Americans, by far the largest group of Americans ever to fight in somebody else's civil war. These are some of the first American volunteers arriving in Barcelona in 1937. The volunteers who survived the war are all dead now, but one of the things that made me interested in writing about this subject is that I knew half a dozen of them. All of them dead now, all of them men who were 30 or 40 years older than me, but I often heard them tell their stories about fighting in Spain, and it was one of the things that drew me into this subject a long time ago. The American volunteers came from 46 of what was then 48 states. Most, though by no means all of them, were members or supporters of the Communist Party. They came from every walk of life, from the son of a former governor of Ohio to a vaudeville acrobat, teachers, lumberjacks, longshoremen, dock workers, seamen. Why did they go? Above all, a sense that the greatest threat to the world at that point was a rapidly expanding fascism, something that sooner or later threatened all countries. One American volunteer who survived the war, Maury Kolau of New York, later said, "For us, it wasn't Franco. It was always Hitler." Another who did not survive, Hyman Katz, 23 years old, wrote to his mother from Spain a couple of months before he was killed there, saying that if he hadn't come, forever afterwards, he would ask himself, "Why didn't I wake up when the alarm clock rang?" Some of the Americans who went were college students. The man on the right in this picture came from Oberlin College, the other four here from New York University. And the American volunteers fought in most of the crucial battles of the war. Of those 2,800 Americans, 750 were killed, more than one out of four. That's a much higher death rate than the U.S. military had in either of the world wars. And hundreds of the remainder were wounded, many of them seriously. They fought often in broiling heat. This photo was taken just before the Battle of the Ebro in the summer of 1938, where at one point the temperature was measured at 98 degrees in the shade, 134 in the sun. They fought another battle at Teruel in the wintertime, where at one point the temperature was measured at 18 degrees below zero. Now, when I write history, I like to try to bring a period of time alive by focusing on the lives of a small number of people who lived through it. And several of those that I zero in this book are among those Americans who volunteered to fight. Here are two of them, a couple, Bob and Marion Merriman. This photograph was taken on their wedding day in 1932, the day that they both graduated from the University of Nevada at Reno. Bob Merriman was an athlete there. At one point, he played end on the college football team. A few months later, after graduating from the University of Nevada, they moved to Berkeley, where Bob became a graduate student in economics and then head teaching fellow in the Department of Economics at Berkeley. And I felt a sense of connection with this couple because in going through their papers in the Bancroft Library on the UC campus, I discovered that they lived, while they were in Berkeley, only a few blocks away from where I do today. And every time I walk from my house to the Graduate School of Journalism where I teach a class, I go past the building where they lived. Bob Merriman, here he is in Spain. When he was working his way through the University of Nevada, he had a variety of jobs, worked as a fraternity house manager, worked in a department store, worked in a funeral parlor, and he discovered that you could earn extra money, $8.50 a month, which was a lot of money in the Depression years, by taking ROTC. So when he arrived in Spain, he was one of the very few American volunteers who had had any kind of military training, whatever, and he was almost immediately made commander of the American battalion. He was wounded, then recovered, went back into action, and became chief of staff of the 15th International Brigade, the unit that included all American, British, and Canadian volunteers, and some from other countries as well. A man widely respected for his charisma and bravery. You can find a lot of the correspondents who were in Spain at that time interviewed him and wrote about him. His wife, Marion, went to Spain also, became the only American woman working in International Brigade's headquarters, doing clerical work as a corporal in the Spanish Army. Americans went to Spain not only to fight, but to do other things. Many of them were medical workers, doctors and nurses. The woman in the foreground in this picture, Celaria Key, was a nurse from Harlem Hospital in New York. In Spain, at one point, she found herself in charge of a ward with five white nurses working under her, something which would never have happened in the United States at that time. Couple of the people that I focus on in the book were among these medical volunteers. Here's one, a man named James Nugis, who was a well-published poet in the United States, became an ambulance driver in Spain, and he kept a diary while he was there. By the way, do future historians a favor and keep diaries. Wonderful material for us to work from. He died young. He was wounded in Spain but survived the war, died young only about 10 years after he came home. People had known that he was keeping a diary in Spain, but everyone assumed it had been lost, including his widow. Until in 2010, a transcript of the diary was found on sale in a Vermont used bookstore. Nobody is quite sure how it got there. It was then published. Two Bay Area scholars, Peter Glazer and Peter Carroll, edited it for publication, and I think it's perhaps the finest piece of writing by an American volunteer who went to Spain. Someone else I follow in the book is a nurse named Toby Jensky, who came to Spain from Beth Israel Hospital in New York. At one point, she fell in love with a wounded soldier. And it's always fascinating when you can try to reconstruct a love affair from several different angles. In this case, we have letters from her. By the way, do historians another favor and keep your letters. We have a memoir by him, and we have an account by somebody who knew them both in Spain and says that it didn't happen at all the way he describes in his memoir. Some other people that I follow in the book and got quite interested in were the correspondents who covered the war. Here are some of them observing and photographing a bombardment. During the time that it went on, from mid-1936 to early 1939, the war was a huge news story. During that period, there were more than 1,000 front-page stories in the New York Times about the Spanish Civil War, more than on any other single topic: the re-election of President Roosevelt, the rise of Hitler, the toll of the Great Depression, anything else. Nearly 1,000 foreign correspondents reported from Spain at one time or another during the war. A volunteer wrote home at one point saying, "Everybody but Shakespeare is here." Here's one group of correspondents, and here in the middle of it, as he always managed to be in the middle of any group he was in, is Ernest Hemingway, who was, of course, the most famous of that group of correspondents. With him in Spain was his then-lover, later third wife, Martha Gellhorn, who wrote for Collier's magazine. In this picture, she's with Bob Merriman from Berkeley, whom I was just telling you about. Now, for the many correspondents in Spain, the big story that they wrote more about than anything else was the bombing of Madrid. These are Italian planes bombing Madrid. It was a huge story because it was the first time that a major European capital had been under heavy, sustained aerial bombardment. And the correspondents wrote hundreds of thousands of words about this. But I grew interested in the stories that they missed, because I've sometimes reported from abroad myself, occasionally from conflict zones. And one thing I've noticed about journalists in such places is that we tend to practice a kind of a herd behavior. Reporters often travel in packs and aim their camera lenses and their notebooks at the same story. And there's a reason for this, which is that the last thing that any reporter in the field wants to get is a message from an editor back home saying, the other newspaper or the other network is reporting this or that, and why haven't we heard anything about it from you? So correspondents in the field tend to keep a very close eye on what their colleagues are reporting and to be sure that they report the same stories. This was all the more true in Spain, because the foreign correspondents in Madrid all stayed at the same hotel, the Hotel Florida. They ate dinner together every night in the same restaurant at a long table that was reserved for the foreign press. And they tended to report the same stories. So for me, looking back on this 80 years later, the question becomes, what stories did they miss? I'm always fascinated by the difference between how events are reported at the time and what looms larger when we look back on it. In Spain, there were two really big stories that they missed. The first one got a tiny bit of mention in the press. The second, absolutely none. Here's the first one. In most of northeastern Spain, Barcelona, surrounding Catalonia, Aragon, the region next door, Franco's military coup was initially defeated not by loyal army soldiers, but by badly armed, hastily organized militia units that had been set up by left-wing political parties or trade unions. These militias often included women. They were, above all, filled with anarchists. The anarchist tradition was very strong in Spain, even though paradoxically it had died out almost everywhere else in the world by the late 1930s. And for a period of some months, these workers' militias found themselves in control of a large swath of the Spanish Republic. And they carried out the most far-reaching social revolution that Western Europe has ever seen. Workers took over factories and sometimes converted them to making badly needed munitions for the front, like this homemade armored car made by auto workers in Barcelona, where workers took over the Ford and General Motors plants, among other things. Railway engine drivers took over the train system in the Northeast. Those are the initials of the anarchist trade union on the side of that locomotive. Peasants took over these large estates where they had once worked as landless laborers. At Barcelona's Hotel Ritz, the fanciest in the city, the restaurant got taken over by its cooks, waiters, and busboys, who turned it into People's Cafeteria Number 1 for the poor. The foreign correspondents in Spain almost entirely ignored this social revolution. They seldom wrote about it. They were too busy trying to keep up with each other, reporting the bombing of Madrid and the other battles in the war. So in the book, I take you through that social revolution through the eyes of two young Americans who found themselves in the middle of it. This is the photo page from their joint passport, Lois and Charles Orr. Lois Orr was a student at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. Earlier in 1936, the spring of 1936, she had married Charles Orr, who was an instructor in economics there. They were leftists, but very strongly anti-Stalinist. They decided to see the world on their honeymoon. They went to Europe. They were traveling in France and Germany when they began hearing about this army officers' revolt in Spain and this remarkable social revolution that was going on at the same time. And Lois, who was very much the live wire of this couple, insisted to her somewhat older, somewhat stodgier husband that they go there. They hitchhiked to Barcelona and crossed the Spanish border 2 months after the coup had begun, and lived and worked there for the next 10 months. Lois Orr was 19 years old. She wrote the most extraordinary series of letters home during that period, spent much of the rest of her life writing and rewriting a memoir of her 10 months in Barcelona that was never published. And all of this is by far the most extensive record by any American, perhaps of any by any foreigner, of Spain's social revolution. They met other young idealists from all over Europe who had come to Barcelona to witness this, who were fascinated that here was a revolution that seemed to be bubbling from the bottom up rather than being imposed from the top down like the one in the Soviet Union. One person who moved in their circles in Barcelona, lived and worked in the same buildings as they did, was a 23-year-old political refugee from Germany named Willy Brandt. Another person that they crossed paths with became even more famous. He's in this photo at the far left in the militia unit he joined in Barcelona, and he is, of course, George Orwell. In Orwell's memoir of this period, Homage to Catalonia, which I think is one of the great nonfiction books of the 20th century, he, unlike the foreign correspondents, he does write very eloquently of this period of social revolution that they ignored. I'll read you a little snippet of his description from there. Waiters looked you in the face and treated you as an equal. Servile and even ceremonial forms of speech had temporarily disappeared. Nobody said señor or don. Everyone called everyone else comrade and thou. Almost my first experience was receiving a lecture from a hotel manager. All this was queer and hotel manager for trying to tip a lift boy. All this was queer and moving. I recognized it immediately as a state of affairs worth fighting for. Orwell spent, he was only in Barcelona for a week. Then he spent almost all the rest of his time in Spain at the front. Here's the other story that the foreign correspondents reporting from Spain at the time missed. And in this case, they wrote not a word about it. A modern military runs on oil. Tanks, and these are some of the tanks that Mussolini gave to the Spanish nationalists, run on diesel fuel. Trucks run on gasoline. Aircraft run on aviation gasoline. Those bombers over Madrid, like this Nazi Henkel 111 bomber, ran on aviation fuel. And all the time the correspondents were writing about the bombing of Madrid, they never looked up and wondered whose fuel is powering those aircraft. It should have been an obvious question, because nationalist Spain had no oil wells. Germany and Italy, which were sending it enormous supplies of military equipment, were oil importers, not exporters. It would have been possible but very expensive for them to advance Franco's nationalists the money to buy oil on the world market. And if you bought oil on the world market, where would it come from? Most likely from the United States, which was the world's major source of oil at that time, especially the state of Texas. However, American neutrality legislation said that the U.S. could not sell arms to either side in a country engaged in civil war, and that anything else, like oil, going to a country at war, first of all, could not travel on American ships, and nationalist Spain had no oil tankers, and it could not be sold on credit. And the Spanish nationalists had very little cash because it was the Republic that had managed to keep Spain's gold reserves. Well, for General Franco and his friends, this was not a problem, because Franco had an admirer who happened to be the head of a major American oil company. His name was Torkild Reber, and he was the CEO of Texaco. And oil companies then, as they still do today, tended to make their own foreign policy. And Reber quite happily sold the Spanish nationalists most of their oil. He sold it on credit, violating U.S. law, and he sold it at a huge discount, something about which he never told Texaco shareholders. It's not in any of the company's annual reports. And as far as we can tell, he never even told his own board of directors, because it doesn't appear in the minutes of their meetings. Reber was a guy who liked dictators. He liked strong men, whether Hitler, Mussolini, Franco, later on the Shah of Iran. And what he would do, and also something else he did, was that, you know, I mentioned the Spanish nationalists had no oil tankers, not a problem. Texaco had one of the world's largest ocean-going fleets of tankers. And in another violation of U.S. law, Reber shipped Texaco oil to nationalist Spain on Texaco's own tankers. What he would do is these tankers would load up at the Texaco pipeline terminal in Port Arthur, Texas, ostensibly bound for Rotterdam, Amsterdam, Antwerp. U.S. customs agents would come on board and would be shown paperwork showing that that's where they were going. Then, once at sea, the captains would open sealed orders redirecting them to ports in nationalist-held Spain. So those bombers over Madrid were fueled by Texas oil. And that's not all. Reber was such an enthusiast for Franco that he went to nationalist Spain twice during the war. The second time, he got a VIP tour of the front. He's second from the right in this photo. The man at the far left wearing a black hat is another Texaco employee named William Brewster, who was head of Texaco's Western European operations based in Paris. And Reber and Brewster put Texaco at Franco's service in another way. Being a major multinational oil company, Texaco had in ports all over the world, tank farms, loading docks, installations, agents of one kind or another. And in the oil business, as in all kinds of other businesses, one company tends to know what its competitors are doing. And indeed, it's pretty hard to disguise a giant oil tanker that is taking on cargo somewhere. Reber and Brewster sent out messages to Texaco people in ports everywhere, asking them to telegraph immediately, as soon as they could get it, any information regarding oil tankers carrying cargo to the Spanish Republic. And this information was then immediately passed on to the Nationalist High Command, where it was very useful for bomber pilots and submarine captains looking for targets. Over the course of the Spanish Civil War, 29 tankers bound for the Spanish Republic were sunk, damaged, or captured. And in one or two cases, we can trace that directly to information supplied by Texaco. Here's one such case. This is a letter that William Brewster wrote to the head of the Nationalist Oil Monopoly, July 2, 1937, about a tanker bound for the Spanish Republic that was stopped, that was anchored off a French port near Bordeaux. The letter gives important information. In the first paragraph, he gives the title of the ship, the SS Kempo Amor, fully loaded with a cargo of gasoline. In the second, he gives identifying information. Her name and port of registry have been painted out. Her hull and funnel are now painted black. She's taking on food, which seems to indicate an immediate departure. There was a separate document included with this letter from the Texaco man at the docks at this port, which gave some additional information which proved crucial, which was that as long as the ship was anchored off the French port, most of the crew went ashore every evening. All of this information was immediately sent to the Nationalists. A couple of days later, when the ship, the SS Kempo Amor, was still anchored there, in the evening, when most of its crew was ashore, it was boarded by a Nationalist raiding party and sailed to a port in Nationalist Spain. So the history books will tell you that the United States was neutral in this war, but Texaco had gone to war. Well, with this kind of help from Texaco, and of course the continued massive flow of arms from Hitler and Mussolini, Franco's Nationalists advanced relentlessly. By late 1937, they held more than half of Spain, and as you can see, the gray area on the map, there was one finger of Nationalist territory which penetrated very deep into the remaining territory held by the Republic and almost came close to reaching the Mediterranean. In March 1938, the Nationalists launched the largest offensive of the war, heavily supported by German and Italian planes and tanks and lots of Italian troops trying to drive that finger of their territory towards the Mediterranean. The Republic's forces, which included the American units, were vastly outnumbered and overwhelmed, forced into a long, disastrous retreat, took tens of thousands of casualties overall. Hundreds of Americans were killed and wounded over the course of this four-week retreat. And by the end of it, after this month-long offensive, Franco's troops did succeed in reaching the Mediterranean and cutting the Spanish Republic's territory in two. The war would last another 10 months, but by this point it was pretty clear that the Republic was doomed. There was a vast flow of refugees who didn't want to live under Franco's dictatorship. Hundreds of thousands fled. At the end, in early 1939, 500,000 Spaniards fleeing Franco crossed the Pyrenees into France. The war was over, and the Spanish Republic had lost. Franco celebrated his victory in Madrid in the spring of 1939 and remained dictator of Spain for the rest of his life, 36 years. Because the story I was trying to tell is mainly that about Americans in the war, let me finish by coming back to the Americans who went to Spain, and I'm going to show you pictures of just a few of those who didn't return. Norman Lisberg, a carpenter from Louisiana, killed at that winter battle that I showed you a picture of, Teruel, January 25th, 1938. James Lardner, originally a journalist for the New York Herald Tribune, came from a famous literary family. His father was Ring Lardner, the humorist, the last American volunteer to enlist and one of the last to be killed. Samuel Willis from Philadelphia, a laborer in the United States, a scout and runner in Spain, killed in action March 17, 1938, on that disastrous retreat. Abraham Chaikin was wrestling coach at the City College of New York, went missing in action the same day as Willis was killed. And finally, Bob Merriman of Berkeley, whom I told you about before, whose story threads through the book, who also went missing in action on that retreat. When I went to Spain while writing the book, I went to the place where he was last seen alive, which was a hilltop in the northeast near the town of Gandesa. A lovely scene today, vineyards, olive groves, red terracotta roofs on those villages in the valley. But on April 2nd, 1938, it was a grim one. Merriman was leading a group of the Republic's troops, American volunteers, Spaniards, people from other countries. They reached this hill at dawn. Franco's troops were on their heels. They knew that if they could get across this valley and over that mountain range, they could reach the Republic's territory and be safe on the other side. But when they reached the hilltop, they saw that they were surrounded and that Franco's troops and some of Mussolini's Italians were coming into this valley from the roads on either sides. They split up into smaller groups to try to escape their encirclement. Most of them did not make it. If Merriman's story seems at all familiar, a tall, athletic, former university instructor from the American West who loses his life in Spain, it's because Ernest Hemingway knew him well in Spain and took some of his characteristics for the hero Robert Jordan of Hemingway's novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls. So why don't I stop right there, and I would be glad to hear your comments and questions. I have one question for you, though, before then. Did anybody here have a relative who was in Spain at this time? Yeah.
And my mother worked for the Joint Anti-Fascist Refugee Committee, which helped persons escape. And I was all of three, and I danced on the boardwalk in New York to raise money to send ambulances to Spain. So when you entitle this, you know, Spain always in your heart, it is a part of my whole life. And it remains always a warning and a harbinger of where we should be and what we should be defending. Certainly globally today, there are many such places.
Good. Thank you.
Great. I'd just like to remind our audience that they're listening to Adam Hochschild speaking on his book, Spain in Our Hearts.
So, thank you. I had family in a village outside of Malaga, Alura, but they were distant families. Most of my family had already come to the United States at that time.
Good.
Comments?
I'd like to ask you, I understand that Mexico was the only country that officially supported the Republican government during the war and was not only an official diplomatic support, but it was translated into material for the war and training and men and so on. Would you mind to comment on that, please?
That's true. Mexico was the only country until the Soviet Union came along which sent help, and they sent help immediately. President Lázaro Cárdenas sent 20,000 rifles, which came as soon as he heard about the uprising in Spain, which came at a time when the Spanish Republic only had one rifle for every three men who wanted to fight. He sent it as a gift. The Spanish Republic insisted on paying for it. He insisted on taking less money than the weapons were actually worth. And there were Mexican volunteers also in the international brigades.
Sir, I won't embarrass you by telling you what a great author I think you are and how I love your books. But what was the role of the Basque population during the war? Were they active in it? Were they affected?
Well, the Basque territory of Spain, then as now, is a place where there have been quite strong feelings in favor of autonomy or independence of some kind. Under the Spanish Republic, the Basques were granted much more autonomy than they had previously held under the monarchy. But Franco and the Nationalists were determined that Spain would be a tightly controlled unitary state. And indeed, when they did finally take over the whole country, they banned the speaking of Basque and Catalan in public. All schooling, government business, and so forth had to be in Castilian Spanish. So in general, the Basque territory was very strongly allied with the Republic. If you remember from those maps on the wall, it was cut off fairly early in the war. But it was definitely fighting an alliance with the Republic. One thing that was different in the Basque country from the rest of Spain is that there the Catholic clergy generally backed the Republic and routinely preached and did much of their church business in Basque. And it was one place where the Nationalists killed many members of the Catholic clergy, whereas in the rest of Spain, large numbers of Catholic clergy were killed by angry mobs in Republic's territory because they were assumed to be backing the Nationalists.
You've already mentioned press coverage of the war. I wonder if you could say a few words about the New York Times in particular, which had a reporter on each side, Herbert Matthews on the Republic side, and as I recollect, an Irish Catholic from New York covering the Nationalist side in a not particularly fair-minded way. And perhaps you could also add something about the way those two reporters' copy was edited once it hit New York.
Okay. It's a fascinating story, and I go into it quite a bit in the book. The Times, in this very diligent New York Times fashion, set out to cover the war very thoroughly and commendably sent reporters to both sides. Herbert L. Matthews, quite well-known journalist, was the main Times person on the side of the Spanish Republic. The fellow covering the war on the Franco's side was indeed a Catholic, although he was a Texan, not a New Yorker, William P. Kearney. And both of these men became ardent enthusiasts of the respective side that they were covering, completely blind to its faults. And their copy was, you know, night and day in terms of what they reported. They hated each other, and they did their best to make that clear in their news columns in this very indirect way, because in the New York Times, of course, you can't say anything directly, and at least in the news columns, because reporters are supposedly objective. But, for instance, there was one case where I mentioned the town of Teruel, where this battle was fought in the wintertime, which was a major victory for the Republic because it was the first provincial capital captured by Republican forces during the war and held for a couple of months. At one point, Kearney, the Times correspondent on the Nationalist side, reported that Nationalist troops had retaken Teruel. Herbert Matthews, covering the war on the Republic side, knew that that was false because he had just been in Teruel. He made a number of trips there. Matthews was quite good about spending a lot of time right at the front. Kearney tended to write his reports from the rear, rely on Franco's press releases. So he knew that this report that Kearney had written, that Teruel had been retaken, was not true. So he went to Teruel, filed a dispatch from the city, making clear it was in Republic's hands, and then ended it with a line saying something to the effect that in this war one should only believe things one can see with one's own eyes. And everybody knew who that was directed at. In his memoirs, and he wrote several of them, Matthews made a big deal out of how his reports that he sent home from the Spanish Republic were edited horribly in New York and cut to shreds and his reporting distorted and so forth. But I think that's not true. I looked very carefully at the carbon copies of his original dispatches, which he kept and gave to Columbia University on his retirement. And Matthews had a problem which many reporters in the field have, which was that not only did he fall in love with his subject matter, but he tended to write at enormous length. And his stories were way cut down by the Times editors, but he still published many more words during the war than Carney did.
Please flesh out the role of Ernest Hemingway in your story. Was it an adventure, his way of just expressing the poignancy of the event, or did he get personally involved?
Hemingway got very personally involved. Interestingly, up to that point in time, he was really one of the most non-political of American writers. He hadn't even bothered to vote in the 1936 election, for instance. But he had a great affinity to Spain. The book that first brought him to worldwide attention, of course, The Sun Also Rises, is set in Spain. He visited the country many times, wrote a book about Spanish bullfighting in the early 1930s. He had many friends there. And he sort of regarded the nationalist coup attempt as a personal affront and was outraged by it. Went to Spain for four long trips of several months each over the course of the war and wrote many dispatches for a syndicate, the North American Newspaper Alliance, to which were published in some 50 papers, including, for instance, the Los Angeles Times. He was an ardent defender of the Republic. And if any of you have read his novel, For Whom the Bell Tolls, you'll know that it's based on the blowing up of a bridge by a guerrilla band behind enemy lines. Hemingway himself at one point participated in an expedition that did just that, a one-night raid behind enemy lines that blew up a railway bridge. He never wrote or spoke about it, but the leader of this guerrilla band gave an interview about it some years later, and the details check out. He was an ardent defender of the Republic during the war. And at one point he referred to himself in a letter to his editor, Maxwell Perkins, saying, I am under arms. That was how he regarded himself as being there. When the war ended, in the novel he wrote, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and in a couple of short stories that he wrote right after the war, he shows a much more capacious political understanding of the complexities of the Spanish Republic's politics, and in particular the quite nasty role that some of the Soviets played, than he allowed to be shown in his newspaper dispatches during the war. So I still think he's a great novelist, both in that novel and his short fiction published after the war. I would not say that his reporting during the war were great feats of journalism. But such an extraordinary man, such a great writer, and such an obnoxious human being.
The stories that you mentioned, hearing from four survivors, how did that come about? Well, you said you talked to survivors.
Oh, yeah. As I said, there were some 2,800 Americans who fought in Spain. 750 were killed. The rest survived. One of my first jobs a good many decades ago was as a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle down on Mission Street here. And there were two reporters in the newsroom who were veterans of the Spanish Civil War. And when things were slow, I used to ask them, what was it like? And they told me about it. Two other veterans of the war became quite good friends of my wife and I for many years, and often used to talk with them about their experiences. So those were some of the things that made me interested in the war originally, in addition to reading Hemingway and perhaps especially reading George Orwell. Yes, Hank Rubin was one of these friends, a lovely man who owned several restaurants in Berkeley, was a well-known food and wine critic, died maybe 10 years ago, lived in San Francisco in his last years. Oh, of course. It's an, really? At was it University of Illinois Press? Am I remembering that? Yeah. Spain's Cause is Mine, I think. Something like that. Anyway, it's a good book.
Yeah, kind of following up what you said about Roosevelt's reasons for maintaining neutrality. During the period of time we're talking about, I think there was a popular front government in France. Why didn't that government help the Spanish Republic?
That's a good question. There was indeed a popular front government in France, and many people in it wanted to help the Spanish Republic, but eventually they decided not to because France itself was almost on the verge of civil war during that period. There had been people killed in street demonstrations in Paris, thousands of people demonstrating. At one point, Léon Blum, who became the Popular Front Prime Minister in France, was shortly before that happened, was pulled out of his car on the street and beaten up. They knew that there were Franco sympathizers in the high ranks of the French army, and the French government and cabinet eventually decided it would risk a civil disturbance at home if they intervened in any way in Spain. They relented a little bit and sold Spain a small quantity of arms, but they tended to be, you know, military planes with the guns removed and things that didn't work very well.
Thank you. Would you talk a little bit about Portugal's role in this whole war? It seems to not be too well detailed in the book.
Right. Well, for Franco's nationalists, Portugal was very conveniently a semi-fascist dictatorship that was right next door. 8,000 Portuguese volunteered for Franco's army. Portugal provided a launching pad for, in the opening days of the war, for nationalist forces to move into Spain. They allowed the nationalists to use the port of Lisbon to get supplies to their troops until they could, you know, capture ports in Spain. So Portugal was very supportive, and it along with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany was one of the first three governments to actually recognize Franco's regime.
You're so good at going back to the time and having people think about what it is that was like at that moment. And I think maybe a little bit more about a couple of things. You talk about Hitler, of course, and Mussolini. Mussolini had been in power more than 10 years or so in 1936. Hitler about 3 years or 4 years. But they hadn't started any wars. Well, Ethiopia had the Ethiopian War, but yeah. They're clearly fascist, but they weren't as obviously militaristic. But what about Stalin? I mean, in 1936, did Stalin not have a bad reputation at all yet? Or did he already have a bad reputation?
Yeah.
Because it's different. It's different to go back to 1936 and say Stalin joined us. If it was 1953, it would be different than 1936. So maybe a little bit of background.
Well, sure. Well, it was Hitler and Mussolini who had the bad reputations in the West, no question about that, because Hitler, even though he hadn't started any wars yet, was still, you know, making all kinds of threats against Jews and was talking about Germany's need to expand to the East and so forth. And Mussolini, the previous year, 1935, had launched this war against Ethiopia, one of the few parts of Africa that hadn't been already colonized. Russia, Stalin's Russia, was at that time a horror show, but most people in the West did not know that much about it. There were millions of Communist Party members in Europe and the United States who wanted to believe that the Soviet Union was paradise. And the terrible toll of the Depression in the West was something that it made made it easier for many people to believe that things were better in Russia. You know, you didn't hear about strikes there. You didn't hear about unemployment there. You also didn't hear about the man-made famine that killed some 5 million Soviets in the early 1930s. And one of the reasons that you didn't hear about it is that the New York Times correspondent there, Walter Duranty, covered it up, as did a number of other U.S. newspaper correspondents there. They didn't write about it. They didn't investigate it. So, so Stalin's crimes and the real nature of the Soviet Union was really not as widely known in the West as it later became. 1936, of course, when the Spanish Civil War began, was also just the moment that Stalin launched another round of bloodletting in the Soviet Union with the Great Purge, where for the next 3 years, millions of Soviets were arrested. They now believe somewhere around 800,000 or 900,000 were executed, the remainder sent to the Gulag. This was something that certainly did start to shake the faith of some communists in Western countries, because you remember these purge trials in the Soviet Union. People were forced to confess to horrible crimes. So you had, you know, revolutionaries like Lev Kamenev and Grigory Zinoviev, who were confessing to being agents of Hitler. And these guys were Jews as well as communists. But so some communists in the West found all this rather hard to believe. One of the fascinating things for me about this period is that that was going on at the same time as the Spanish Civil War going on. Some people whose faith in communism was shaken by the events in Russia thought, well, at least they are supporting the Spanish Republic. I deliberately, in the book, tried to have in my cast of characters people of different political beliefs to sort of show how different people experienced this time politically. For example, Bob and Marion Merriman, whom I showed you pictures of, they were Communist Party members and never questioned their faith. Another person I follow is a journalist named Louis Fisher, who was the correspondent in Moscow for The Nation magazine in the U.S., who was very much a true believer up until the first purge trial in 1936, where a couple of the people who went on trial were friends of his. This shook him deeply. But just at that moment, the Spanish Civil War began, and he sort of tried to fend off some of his doubts about the Soviet Union by going to Spain, and actually became the first American to go into uniform there, although he fairly soon afterwards reverted to being a journalist. But then in Spain, he began to see the nasty way some of the Soviets there dealt with, people they considered Trotskyites. And he very much lost his faith in communism and was kind of dealing with this all through the Spanish Civil War, although he remained an ardent supporter of the Spanish Republic. Another volunteer I follow, actually the guy who fell in love with the nurse, was someone who regarded himself as a definitely non-communist radical. He said, I would never join the Communist Party because they had no sense of humor, and that if you made a joke in a party meeting, you were treated as if you farted in church. And he said, but these were the only people raising large numbers of volunteers to go to Spain, and so I was willing to go.
You mentioned just a moment ago the pernicious effect that some of the Soviet and communist volunteers to the Spanish cause created. Could you expound on that a little bit?
Well, here's what happened. The Soviet Union, as I mentioned, became the only major country. We should give credit to Mexico. You're right about that. But became the only major country to supply arms to the Spanish Republic. In return, Stalin demanded and got high positions in the Spanish Republic's Army High Command and the security forces for both Spanish and Soviet communists. To some extent, this was motivated by wanting to have military professionals in charge of things, because these Soviets, after all, had fought and won the Russian Civil War and knew something about fighting war, whereas in Spain, most of the professional army officers had gone with the nationalists. But Stalin was also determined that if he was going to put up the money and the arms, he wanted Spanish communists to get as much influence as possible. And they did achieve a large amount of influence. They dominated the security police and used those positions to arrest and execute a number of non-Stalinist folks on the left. That was a, you know, that this was one of the things that people like Hemingway and Herbert Matthews ignored during the war in their correspondence. However, there were never Soviet-style purge trials in Spain. The communists never got control of the judicial system. And so although there were some deaths that shouldn't have happened, it was never on the scale of what happened in the Soviet Union.
Hi. I just want to elaborate a little on what this gentleman just asked. Was that the only internal conflict, was there within the non-Soviet advocates a split? Because that, and if there was, how much impact do you think that had on the outcome of the war?
Well, there was a split because the Spanish Republic, although it was a democracy, was a very fractious democracy with a bewildering array of political parties. Some of them were what we would call, you know, liberal democratic parties, like, you know, the Christian Socialists or Christian Democrats in Western Europe today. Then there was a sizable group of, and initially, at the moment the war began, there was also a Spanish Communist Party, but it had a very small membership. It gained tremendously in influence thanks to the Soviet arms, but it was quite small at the beginning. The Socialist Party was divided between right and left wings, and then there was this quite large group of anarchists who traditionally did not take part in elections because anarchists were opposed to participating in governments of all kinds. But finally, there was a unity government formed in the fall of 1936, where for the first time ever, four Spanish anarchists had cabinet positions. I talked about this social revolution in northeastern Spain, which was very much the work of the anarchists. It was very much opposed by both the mainstream parties of the Spanish Republic, who were no enthusiasts of revolution to begin with, even though they were small-D Democrats. And it was opposed by the communists, who wanted, if there was to be any revolution, it was to be imposed from the top down, as it had been in the Soviet Union, and not from the bottom up, with workers taking over factories and all this kind of thing. In addition, I hate to concede the communists and their allies a point on anything, but I think they did have a good point in feeling that when you're up against an army backed by Hitler and Mussolini, it's not a time to experiment with social revolution. Because some of the things the anarchists did were quite extraordinary. They opened prison doors and let everybody out of prison, including common criminals. They didn't believe in the use of paper money. They thought everything should be on a barter system, so they burned huge piles of paper money. I mean, these things might be interesting to experiment with in peacetime, but I think not in a kind of desperate war for survival. They finally came to blows in Barcelona in May 1937, where the remnants of this social revolution that was mainly stoked by the anarchists were suppressed. Several hundred people were killed. The communists and their mainstream allies did this. And this is something that George Orwell was caught up in. He was in Barcelona on leave, and he writes about this in Homage to Catalonia.
All right, we have time for two more questions.
Hi, I'd like to know if you'd share your views on the legacy of the Spanish Civil War, certainly immediately after the death of Franco, because I'm guessing that during his time there was probably one narrative. and then even looking closer to today, too, the legacy.
You mean how people are remembering it today in Spain? I'm no expert on that because I did not spend a lot of time in Spain. And when I did, I was mainly looking for places like this where the Americans I'd been writing about lived and worked and fought. But certainly it's a very uncomfortable legacy in Spain for this reason. Even though the war itself ended in 1939, well before most people alive today were born, Franco remained in power until 1976. And so there are many, many people alive in Spain today who were part of the regime because his secret police was torturing people right up to the very end. And there was a case a year or two ago where a Spaniard who had been a political prisoner in the last years of the Franco regime, the early 1970s, at one point recognized on the street in Madrid, running in a marathon, his former torturer. And he brought a lawsuit and so on. So there's been a lot of talk in Spain about should any of these crimes from that era be punished. Generally, the courts have not wanted to get into that. There certainly are many Spaniards who are deeply interested in the war, and some of them have a special interest in the international volunteers. In 1996, which was the 60th anniversary of the start of the war, and at that point there were still a lot of these international brigade volunteers from many countries who were still alive. They had a reunion of several hundred of them in Madrid and Barcelona, and they were greeted by enormous crowds of Spaniards and people throwing flowers at them, cheering them, filling large arenas, and it's very moving to hear those descriptions. So, and it's something that people still feel very divided about. I spoke about this book in New York a couple of weeks ago, and there was a man there, a consul from the Spanish consulate, who told me that one of his grandfathers had been killed by the forces of the Spanish Republic. Another of his grandfathers had been killed by the Spanish nationalists. A great uncle of his who had been a Republic sympathizer and was a practicing doctor and a surgeon was performing surgery in a hospital at the moment that it got occupied by nationalist troops and had to quickly strip off his uniform and hide it. In millions of Spanish families, there are stories like this of the divisions that people came from.
I guess just finally, can you speak briefly about Robert Capa and his photography of the Spanish Civil War?
Yeah, actually the photo on the cover of my book of the guy holding a wounded child, that's a Capa photo, a civilian casualty from the Battle of Teruel. Capa was a wonderful photographer, very young at the time he went to Spain. That was where he made his name. His photographs are by far the best that anybody took there. His then lover, Gerda Taro, also a talented photographer, was killed in Spain. And one has to work hard to find something other than Capa photographs to illustrate a book like this, but I couldn't help but use some of them, even though they're very well known pictures.
Thank you very much, Adam, for
thank you, George.
Great explanation. And Adam's book is available in the lobby. Do you sign your books?
Sure.
Adam signs his books. So thank you very much. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 114th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you.